This is a reading of the collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Approaching the Mystery of Golgotha. This is Lecture 8, entitled The Christ Spirit and Its Relation to the Evolution of Consciousness, given in Munich on March 30, 1914. Everything that enters our efforts is crystallized in the end around one point, finding the connection with the spiritual powers that carry humanity forward. From this point of view, again and again, the topic here has been the significance of the Christ being in the world. Today I should like to say a few words that should be suitable to make our ideas about the Christ impulse and its relationship with us human beings increasingly more substantial. If we wish to grasp the Christ impulse in its reality, we must get used to reflecting on various things. Indeed, in our time, we hear nothing more than the thought expressed here and there that one should express everything smacking of the schoolmaster, everything pedantic, everything didactic, and seize on living life in art and philosophy. So many minds of the present express their fatigue with everything academic. It is remarkable that, just as philosophical issues become the topic, one falls back again and again into the yearning for the academic. We have had to listen to people speaking about Christ as though about a world teacher. I once used the expression, quote, superhuman schoolmaster to the world, unquote. Many people feel good when they can think that with Christ someone came into the world who taught something. In contrast, we have repeatedly stressed the character of the life and the character of the power of the Christ impulse. Through what happened at the baptism in the Jordan, a being found the way into earthly life through sharing the fate of humanity for 3 years. Then this being flowed out into the aura of the earth, and since then carries on its work there. If one looks at the Christ event, one must say that this event of Golgotha is a unique experience in the evolution of the earth. It was accomplished once in the evolution of the earth. However, the Christ event was prepared in the spiritual world. Although it is thoroughly false to think of the Christ being as being in another body, one must nonetheless refer to a preparatory event, or namely, three preliminary stages to the event of Golgotha in the evolution of the world. They transpired in the purely spiritual worlds. I spoke about the two boys named Jesus, the Solomon Jesus boy and the Nathan Jesus boy. The Solomon boy carried the eye of Zoroaster, which then went over into the other boy and lived there from the 12th to the 30th year. Then the quote-unquote husk, the sheath of this Jesus, was filled with the Christ being. This Nathan Jesus was also thus properly incarnated in a human body in the world for the first time. Parenthesis, that must be expressly mentioned. Parenthesis, he was born at the beginning of our time, reckoning, and previous to that he was never actually incarnated in a human body. The relation to Krishna was not an actual incarnation, but an ersatz incarnation. If we consider the essence of this later Nathan Jesus, we must look to the angelic being and say that he was not incarnated before Christ appeared on the earth, but rather was present in the spiritual world and was ensouled 3 times. And in each of these 3 stages of existence, everything similar to the event of Golgotha occurred for him. We must therefore seek, in the spiritual worlds, the stages that presaged Golgotha. Each of these events has a deep significance for the entire life of human beings on earth. What we there experience is not influenced only by what happens within the physical world, but also from spiritual worlds. The effects of the 3 preliminary stages were brought in from outside the earthly realm. The Luciferic influence had already descended over humanity in the Lemurian epoch. Lucifer sent, as it were, his rays of power into human nature, affecting it inwardly. The human being would have necessarily developed in another way if no Luciferic influence had come. The human being was, so to speak, infected with the Luciferic impulse. From the viewpoint of spiritual science, we can say what the effect of this luciferic influence was. Had this influence remained as strong as in Lemuria, something would have gravely threatened our human nature. We can characterize what would have occurred approximately like this. The 12 powers of the human senses, for there are 12, would have formed in such a way that the human being would have become oversensitive. The red of the rose has an objective effect on us today, as we look at it. At that time, red would have pierced our eyes as if with barbs, and blue would have sucked on our power of sight. We would have been oversensitive. It would have been the same with hearing and the other human sense impressions. We would have been able to perceive nothing without feeling pain or desire. That was what confronted humanity through Lucifer. The beings of the upper hierarchies saw this. The Nathan Jesus who lived on earth at a later time was present as an angelic being in the spiritual world during the Lemurian age, and his task was to be penetrated by the Christ being. While the sheaths were later penetrated with the Christ being, the soul elements of this angelic being were spiritually imbued with the Christ impulse. Already, back then, the Christ impulse sank down into the soul of the future Nathan Jesus. This event occurred in the spiritual world, but the radiance emerging from it spread out over the earth and soothed the oversensitive human senses, so that the danger that people could only behold the sense world with either pain or debasing lust was eliminated. So we look at the first harbinger of the event of Golgotha and recognize that our 12 senses became as they are due to the fact that the Christ sank into the soul of the future Nathan Jesus and softened the nature of the human senses. Then, in the Atlantean age, a danger once again came into human life through a gradual joining together of the Ahrimanic influence with the Luciferic influence. While in Lemuria it was the senses that confronted the danger, now in the early Atlantean period the life organs and the etheric body of the human being stood in danger. Had these organs of the etheric body been permeated with the influence of Lucifer and Ahriman, human beings would have assumed a form unworthy of the human being. Everything would have been made in such a way that human beings would have pursued what was useful to them with avidity, and could only have looked at what was not advantageous with disgust. Human life would have run its course between greed and repulsion. All organs would have been so constituted that human beings would have pounced in a degrading fashion like a wild animal on what they had to take, and would have felt deeply humiliated if confronted by anything that was not beneficial to them. That this did not come to pass was due to the second preliminary stage of the event of Golgotha. The danger was such that, even in breathing, human beings would have sucked in the air with greed, and every glimmer of something unsuited to them would have been met with terrible outbursts of repulsion. This was the second time this angelic being was permeated with the Christ impulse, and through that rays of power entered the aura of the earth and softened the life of human beings. Toward the end of the Atlantean period, the third preliminary stage developed. Again, humanity confronted a great danger. Now, thinking, feeling, and willing were about to become chaotic. The expressions of the soul were about to be thrown out of harmony, so that human beings would not have been able to develop thinking, feeling, and willing in an orderly way. Rather, these would have rushed around and through one another as if mad. This disharmony was deflected by the third preliminary stage. Once again, the being who later became the Nathan Jesus was penetrated with the Christ impulse, and order and harmony was introduced to the attunement of thinking, feeling, and willing. This was still felt for a long time in post-Atlantean times. In times that preceded our development of thinking, the harbingers of an image that teaches, that reaches into our time, but is not yet rightly understood, already took form. At the end of the Atlantean age, Christ interpenetrated this soul that later became Jesus of Nazareth, with the result that this being became the eternal lord of these effects that wildly stormed around each other. became the victor over thinking, feeling, and willing, which were developing into excessively dense formations. Humanity represented this victory in the image of St. George or Michael, the dragon slayer. That is the direct imaginative expression of the third forerunner of the event of Golgotha. The Greeks, who brought to life in their imaginations what shone over from the secrets of Atlantis, created a divinity from the being that was active in Atlantis. They venerated in Apollo the spirit they imagined to be suffused with the sun spirit. They did not name it Christ, but the name doesn't matter. In their sun service they venerated the third preliminary stage of the event of Golgotha, and expressed it outwardly when they took counsel of the priests of Apollo in the most weighty circumstances. These Greeks knew that interwoven in the secrets of existence is what weaves in the aura of the earth, and they knew it, and they knew how it brought order to thinking, feeling, and willing. They felt that this event was so connected with the earth that they said that what climbed up in a dense form from the earth, if it had not been conquered by Apollo, would have brought thinking, feeling, and willing into disorder. But Apollo brings in order, so that instead of dissonance or madness, wisdom flows from the aura of the earth into thinking, feeling, and willing. The Greeks looked for the place where steam gushed forth from the earth, which they stopped up and caught up in their temple in order to place the priestess of Apollo over the opening. Apollo spoke through the priestess so that she changed into an oracle, giving advice for the situations of those seeking this wisdom. As George and Michael appear in the images, so it is with Apollo in his sanctuary, pouring the prophecies, speaking through him, into the soul. Oh, Christianity is very ancient. The name of Christ doesn't matter. The worship of Apollo venerated Christ, the sun spirit, so that in this veneration lies the consciousness of the third preliminary event of Golgotha. Then the time came when humanity stood before a fourth great danger. In Lemuria, the physical body was in danger, and then in Atlantis the etheric organs and the astral organs. Now it was the eye that was about to lapse into disorder. In preparation for that, when the eye was about to take hold of the human being in Greek thought life, a very strange phenomenon appeared in which all the conditions were present to bring disorder into the eye. People will only gradually understand how what was supposed to drive this I forth developed in Greek philosophy, and so on. I've already attempted to show how the I awakened. Through contemplating philosophy, which reaches its peak in the thought life of Plato and Aristotle, it becomes apparent how the I was gradually approaching. As Thales, Pherecydes of Syros, and Anaxagoras were first calling the great ideas to life, a parallel phenomenon spread from Greece over the entire Greek world. Parallel to the approach of the eye came the phenomenon of the Sibyls. The Sibyls asserted themselves everywhere during this time, occasionally expressing great wisdom for the future, but also in part madness. Everything that can bring the eye into disorder was expressed in their prophecies. The eye must lapse into disorder without the Christ impulse. Two sorts of things were being prepared. On the one side, the prophets, the preparers of the Christ impulse. They sought to receive the young Christ force in the deepening of the soul, and experienced in an ordered thought life what weaves through the evolution of humanity. On the other side were the Sibyls, who were devoted to the external influences of the earth's aura. We encounter this opposition of Sibyls and prophets in Michelangelo's representation in the Sistine Chapel in Rome. Michelangelo shows how the wind and what was connected with the elemental nature of earth were at work among the Sibyls. Michelangelo shows that the danger of the eye lapsing into disorder was present with the Sibyls, as well as how the prophets were at work to quiet the eye. Comparing the prophets with the Sibyls in Michelangelo's pictures can guide us deeply into many secrets. How the human eye will lapse into disorder in the fourth stage is demonstrated in the powers of the Sibyls. The order proclaimed by the teaching of the prophets was revealed through the mystery of Golgotha. The ordering of the eye forces in the form that the human eye learned to feel ever more deeply, not I, but Christ in me. What in the Sibyls would have necessarily contributed to the disorder of the eye emerges in an orderly fashion through the Christ impulse. Because the eye of human beings must develop on earth, the event of Golgotha had to take place on earth. Christ had to permeate the body of Jesus, the real physical body, while in the preliminary stages an angel's soul was permeated. Thus, Golgotha approached the development of the earth. What Augustine said has deep truth. Quote, Christianity has always been there. It is only that one calls it Christianity now. Unquote. In Augustine's times, one felt something of the fact that Apollo's worshippers were Christians, if not by name. People venerated the third preliminary event, which was still spiritual. In this way, Christ gradually approached the earth. The first and second stages were in Devakan, the third in the astral world, and the event of Golgotha in the physical world. However, Christ did not penetrate the aura of the earth as a teacher, but with his power. That must be emphasized over and over again. If Christ had only wanted to do his work through what people could have understood from him, he would have been able to produce little result. He entered evolution as a living being. Human understanding must wrestle its way up to him. We see how disputes of dogma are played out in this struggle. Human judgment is still far from penetrating the Christ impulse, which works into the depths of the soul as a living force. We can follow this force. Let us look at an event of October 28, 312. At that time, Constantine fought a pitched battle with Maxentius outside of Rome. Maxentius' army was four times as strong as Constantine's, yet Constantine won. A person who observes history in the right way recognizes that the life of all of Europe would have been different if Constantine had not won. It was a remarkable battle. Neither external strength nor judgment prevailed. The battle was not fought with what proceeded from judgment. It was fought from both sides with subconscious impulses, into which the Christ impulse played. Maxentius consulted the Sibylline books, which told him, quote, if you do not stay in the place where you are, if you go out from Rome, you will enslave the great enemy of Rome, unquote. Also a dream told him he should leave Rome and fight before the gates. In Rome he was securely entrenched. Human judgment did not determine what was at play in this battle. The subconscious worked into the souls of Maxentius and Constantine. A dream revealed to Constantine that he should carry the symbol of Christ at the head of his army. Dreams decided this battle, which determined the fate of Europe. Human judgment was not capable of bringing about what had had to happen. Rather, the Christ impulse intervened and positioned the four times weaker army of Constantine to oppose Maxentius outside Rome. Human affairs were led through what human beings cannot judge. This is significant for the entire guidance of human history. The Christ impulse made its effect in the subconscious of souls as a spiritual impulse. It worked in the same way later, when, once again, the map of Europe received a totally different form. If the Maid of Orleans had not come to the side of her king at the decisive moment, all the destinies of Europe would have been different. Once again, it was not judgment, but the Christ impulse, which made use of a human instrument. It is not for us to judge whether one finds this good or bad. I can show in another example how the Christ impulse works under the threshold of consciousness. It avails itself of strange manifestations, strange to a materialist. As modern spiritual life approached, there was something in its development that would have caused materialism to stretch its arms over European life to an even greater extent. If certain processes had not appeared, it might have been possible that entirely material ideas would have entered even those souls that still felt themselves to be spiritual. Already in earlier centuries, the understanding for the Christ impulse would have declined so far that people would have doubted his physical existence. In that case, Arthur Drews and others would have had a much easier time of it. A mood spread over the most distant parts of Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries, when the danger of losing the connection with the Christ impulse was at hand, that questioned why we should believe that Christ actually lived. And it came about that the same thing happened at the same time in the most diverse parts of Europe. In almost all the regions of Europe, everywhere, it turned out that a physical person, but always a different one in different areas, went through the most diverse human settlements, villages, and cities. The opinion was circulated that this human personality, who appeared, turned out in an especially peculiar way, was Ahasuerus, the Eternal Jew, who has wandered through the world since he rejected Christ. The news spread that there was a living person who could say from personal observation, quote, "I have seen Christ, he really lived," unquote. This person went in a most dreadful state, in old, worn-out clothing, through villages in the most varied places. He took part in religious services and told the story of the event for which he could stand as a witness. Bishops and abbots invited such personages to banquets and organized festivities for them. These personalities always told the same story, quote, "I can confirm for you from knowledge that Christ walked the earth, for he passed by me, and because I dismissed him like that, I must now wander through the world in this way," unquote. From what we learn from history, we have no idea how deeply Ahasuerus' story affected human minds a couple of centuries ago. There were always different individuals who saw, as if in a kind of an Ahasuerus review or reflection, Christ pass by them, so people believed them. The consciousness arose, quote, "Yes, he lived because he can tell the story," unquote. Superficial people today can ask if that should have had such a great influence as to avert the danger that Christ would be forgotten as an historical Christ. They don't know that such events happen in the world without history ever recording them. That we are today not totally bogged down in materialism is a result of what proceeded from these personalities. Today that could not happen. In certain places, Ahasuerus had thick calluses, peculiar clothing, long hair, yellowish skin, and was tall and haggard. In other places he was short and had a humpback, but always he had the awareness of being permeated by the sight which the soul believed it experienced in the moment Christ passed by in front of him. This consciousness, this ability to look back into the Akashic Chronicle and to identify with it so strongly that they really believed it, had sunk into numerous personalities. Today all these Ahasueruses would end up in a lunatic asylum. Back then they were the instruments for the strengthening of spiritual life. Bishops and abbots themselves were strengthened through them in the power of belief in Christ. From spiritual worlds, the seed of being able to look back to the event of Golgotha was planted in spiritually inclined natures. Through the peculiarity of their consciousness, the storytellers saw themselves as present in the picture. It was the true living vision of the event of Golgotha. Much more than in the upper regions of human consciousness, in which the power of judgment is significant, what came from the Christ impulse played itself out in the subconscious regions of the soul. The materialistically minded human beings of today can easily scorn such things, considering it a psychic epidemic, and ask how we can rely on what comes from diseased souls. We might like to ask these materialists what they would say when a man's so mentally ill that the psychiatrists lock him up in a lunatic asylum. Let me read that again. We might like to ask these materialists what they would say when a man so mentally ill that the psychiatrists lock him up in a lunatic asylum, but that he then begins to conceive out of his illumination of the airplane engine, which is actually an idea that people have in mind today. They would accept that from such a soul, without asking whether it came from a diseased mind. That is no criterion no argument for whether a soul is ill or not. It is a matter of testing the content of what comes from the soul. The worst thing about our materialistic spirit is that one appeals to secondary considerations and not to the force of truth. If we survey the evolution of humanity, it will become clear that we should understand the Christ impulse as a living force, which is much more active in the lower levels of the soul and avails itself of physical means more than people understand. If Christ had remained limited to the physical, his influence would never have gone very far. However, in our time, the situation is beginning to change, so that eventually that must be active in us, which for the Greek was thinking, with which in fact the consciousness of the human eye was born at the same time. How does this thinking work today? One does not need to prove it with spiritual science, but rather with philosophy. In the centuries before the founding of Christianity, beginning with Pharisees and ending with Aristotle, thinking got its start in the evolution of the world. Thinking in pictures first began in Greek life. That prepared the true consciousness of the eye. Then comes the Christ impulse, which works together with what has emerged as the force of the eye. In our time, we see it in Hegelian thought. Little attention has been paid to it, but how Hegel wrestles with the thinking that wants to comprehend the entire world is an important phenomenon of humanity. Human beings are evolving in the world. They crown their evolution through by filling the world with thinking. Thinking completes the world. Human beings recognize their surroundings through it. However, thinking can achieve two things. It can develop properly, which can be compared with the development of the seed to the blossom. But the seed can also serve for human nutrition, in which case it will be torn out of its regular continuing flow. If it stays in its continuous flow, it develops into a new plant. Predictably, life for the future comes from it. It is the same with human thinking. We can say that through it we make pictures for ourselves of our surroundings. However, the employment of such knowledge is like using seeds for nutriment. We drive thinking from its flow. If, however, it remains in its flow, then we let it live in its own seed life. We let it unfold in meditation and inspiration and let it develop itself into a new, fertile existence. That is the right flow of thinking. In the future, we will recognize that what we have regarded as knowledge of the world behaves like the grain that does not progress to the new grain, but rather is driven out into a totally different flow. But the knowledge we learn through knowledge of the higher worlds is the thinking that is philosophically comprehended in freedom and that leads directly into spiritual life through meditation and concentration. We stand at a point where it will be recognized that ordinary knowledge is to supersensible knowledge as a grain used for food is to a grain that progresses to a new grain. Inner knowledge of thinking is what the future must bring. Philosophy of the old style has been overcome, is played out. We will know that such knowledge must always be there, but must lead to an evolutionary tributary, and we will know that living thinking, which transforms itself through meditation and concentration, leads to spiritual knowledge of human nature and to knowledge of the spiritual worlds. If we observe various kinds of phenomena in our spiritual life, there is much that is striking. Here we may well say or discuss the sort of thing that would be misunderstood in the outside world. Today, a person who is regarded as a great philosophical mind basically limits his wisdom to talking over and over again about the same subject. He says, quote, human beings should not stop with mere external knowledge. They must grasp the spirit, unquote. He says over and over again, in another version, quote, human beings cannot stop with mere knowledge. They must grasp the spiritual within themselves, must experience it within themselves. It may not be grasped merely in concepts. It must come alive, unquote. Such people are not saying what spirit is. They know nothing about it. That is the hallmark of Eucken's philosophy. It does not lead to true knowledge of the spirit. When we form thinking out of itself, it does not become a vague experience of spirit, but becomes whole in itself, and what we have learned to know as the etheric body comes toward it. In other words, if we transform thinking in meditation, our meditative thought will form itself, and then out of the etheric body our spiritual being will become present. Humanity is on its way in its evolution, from philosophy to a living spiritual knowledge. We are on the straight path. Those who see this understand their time, but it is not possible to gain a real insight into these things without developing reverence for the knowledge, which holds one back with the power of judgment that one has from applying the criterion universally. One must be willing to prepare oneself ever and again, for new knowledge, for in its present state the soul is suited only for a tributary of knowledge. Only when the soul develops to a higher level is it really suited to enter into the spiritual world. We first correctly understand our task within our community when we feel with deep humility how we are called to know something of this great change in all concepts of knowledge which is intended to lead us into the spiritual world. We want to remain utterly modest, but because that is not a derogatory criticism, we can call many a person who is recognized today as a great intellect a shallow chatterer. We must find our way to unite humility with clear, strong, energetic judgment about what we are striving for, and to know that we are actually standing only at the beginning. But our hearts can swell and glow with joy at the thought of what will come, of that toward which we are steering, and to which we wish to devote the most intimate forces of our soul. I should like to turn not only to your power of imagination, but also to the deepest forces of your hearts, to that part of your souls where your deepest feeling for the pulse of the time is to be found. Then you will understand that such talk as this can only hint at what the leading powers of our time want to communicate to us, the spiritual individualities that we know are going through our stream of time. We will make no progress by acquiring only more and more concepts for what the spiritual world is. We must acquire them, but we only start to make real progress when we join with each new thought something that comes from the deepest foundation of our soul, so that this process of, quote, understanding more and more, unquote, can prove itself before the leading powers of our time. We can feel them, how they speak in the most intimate foundation of our soul. Long before we hear this speaking as a warning, we can feel how our anthroposophical movement is carried by these spiritual leading powers, whose heralds we rightly are within our movement. This consciousness should pour itself out over what we are doing as a true current of the soul. The end of Lecture 8.